The school was set on fire in 1913. The Klansmen were very present in Texas during that particular time.
Quakertown rallies after a devastating fire at the Frederick Douglass School, but an even bigger challenge looms. Part two of Quakertown, a Juneteenth labor and migration story, is next on A Third of Your Life.
You spend a third of your life at work. We're all about making it better. This is the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations podcast.
Hundreds of Black Americans migrated to Quakertown, Texas in the late 1800s to enroll their children in the venerable Frederick Douglass School. But in 1913, the building went up in flames, signaling the growing racism that soon threatened the entire community. Welcome to A Third of Your Life. I'm Steve Flemish, and our guest host is Danielle Phillips Cunningham, an associate professor in the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations. Danielle is studying the history of Quakertown, and her guests are working to preserve that history, Alma Clark and Diane Randolph. Now, on A Third of Your Life, Danielle Phillips Cunningham.
Quakertown was a socially vibrant and economically prosperous community established by formerly enslaved Black Americans in Denton, Texas in the late 1800s. And then one day, the school that was really at the center of the town was set on fire. And organizations came together to deal with that catastrophic event. So I guess I'll begin first with Ms. Clark. Can you share with us what happened that morning when parents were sending their children to the Frederick Douglass School?
The school was set on fire in 1913. The Klansmen were very present in Texas during that particular time. And they seemed to think that the Klansmen done it. They're not sure, but it's rumored that they did because there would be no other way. Therefore, one of the lodges in the St. James AME Church opened their buildings up that the children were still able to attend school and stay there until they were able to go to the new school that they later named it the Fred Moore School, after Fred Moore, who was a leading principal and teacher at the school.
Was anyone injured in the fire?
No.
Thank goodness. But we know what the intent was, right? Because it was set on fire at the same time that parents were sending their children to the school. Ms. Randolph, did you want to add to anything about the fire?
Well, I just know that the fire represented a way to try to stamp out hope for the community because the school meant so much. It had to have had a devastating effect on those young people as they looked at that and their parents as they tried to think of where they would go and what they would do. And once again, you had the church and those community organizations which stepped in to assist and help.
And I just want to interject with this interesting story. During the grant project, the team organized a panel discussion at Texas Woman's University about the history of Quakertown. And Ms. Randolph and Ms. Clark were two of the panelists who were part of that discussion. And so just to give you a sense of how almost radical it is to talk about Quakertown's history, even in Denton today, is that during our program, someone set off a fire alarm. And so there was this threat of a fire that was supposed to happen during our actual panel discussion. Of course, it was never discovered who set off the fire alarm, just like, you know, with the school, with the Frederick Douglass School, no one was arrested for setting the school on fire. At Texas Woman's University, no one was found as in terms of who set the alarm, but everyone, I remember that everyone on the panel, including folks who attended the panel discussion, said, I wonder what that was about. was that to stop our conversation about Quakertown and preserving its history. So that's just to give a sense of how, even though this fire happened in the early 1900s, there's still this tension around really preserving Black history and talking about Black history that still exists today. But we all ran to the outside of the building. It was something. But I think everyone walked away from that event knowing that the fire alarm had been pulled on purpose. And so that just, again, speaks to the persistence of that history.
The fire to burn that school was on purpose and meant to frighten.
Yes.
And or stop education as they built lives for their families and their communities.
Yeah, and that's why we were determined to finish the panel discussion, because it was like, no, you're not going to stop this. This is decades in the making. So that leads us to a discussion about the 1921 bond vote, because the fire, right, at the school really represented this growing resentment towards Black people in Denton, you know, Black people who were doing well. And after Quakertown had already been built, then we have a school that was built just a mile north, 1 mile north of Quakertown, known today as Texas Woman's University. So even though Quakertown was established before the school had a problem with Quakertown being there. So would you share with us what led to the 1921 bond vote? Who was involved? Who really kind of corralled the community into supporting the 1921 bond vote? So I'll begin first with you, Ms. Clark.
The school was known as the CIA, College of Industrial Art for White Girls. To get to downtown Denton, they had to come through Quakertown. And the president at that time, along with some of the leading citizens of Denton, felt like it would be dangerous for those white girls to come through this community. And they wanted to move Quakertown out. They came up with the thought that, well, Dallas and Fort Worth had a park, but Denton didn't have a park. And they decided to have a bond election to build a park, and the park was going to be in the place where Quakertown is. They got with the leading citizens, the white citizens of Denton, and the daughters, the federal daughters, and they came up with the idea that that's what we will do. We'll have a bond election, vote it out, and make the area where Quakertown is a park. And in the meantime, when this occurred back in 1921, women was eligible to vote at that time too. So you know that had a strong influence upon the voting. So the voting took place, and they said that about 607 people voted that was eligible to vote. And there was about 240 that was against it, but the vote was carried. Therefore, they won, and they began to send letters and tell the people within Quakertown that they had been voted out and the land was going to become a park.
I wanted to just add that several things started happening there as they were looking for an opportunity to move these people. Now, this had been happening over a period of years. So I think we're talking about 1921 through 23 now. But the College of Industrial Arts had a president who was very powerful within the town itself, working with the state legislature to try to increase the status of that college at that time. And so he looked over there and said, if that was not there, we would be safer here. It would look a little better to parents coming to visit the college and dropping their girls off. We don't want to frighten them. And then you had the Women's Club there, who also threw their influence in that. And the president spoke to the Rotary Club. And so a lot of things, a lot of action and talk came around. Why can't we move those people? They just really formulated a plan to destroy the community. And it was done through a vote of the city. These women also worked faculty-wise, members of that organization also, they made sure that they all voted, the women in particular.
White women.
Yes. So it also speaks to the power of the vote.
Absolutely. And the fact that Black people at the time, because now we're talking about the Jim Crow era, didn't have the right to vote. So if Quakertown, people who lived in Quakertown had the right to vote, the outcome could have been very different. You know, not only in terms of the 1921 bond vote, but everything that happened afterwards that impacted Quakertown descendants' lives for several generations. So Ms. Clark touched on that in terms of white women in the town banding together to draw support for the 1921 bond vote. There were white women's organizations at the time, the Daughters of the Confederacy. They were really strong in Denton. I mean, they had fundraised millions of dollars to build Confederate monuments in Denton. And there's one Confederate monument that was just taken down. When was that? That happened right after the George Floyd protests. I think that was back in 2021 or 2020, somewhere in there. But there had been a Confederate soldier statue in downtown Denton up until that time. So the women's organizations were very strong at that time. As you mentioned, Ms. Randolph, the Rotary Club, which was a business organization, and I think really spoke to the economic resentment that some white people in the town had towards people of Quakertown for their economic prosperity, you know?
Daniel, they wanted to actually use those people's land for a park.
Yeah.
If we make a park there and move these people. So we have beautification, allegedly, or citizens' rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also wanted to highlight something Ms. Clark mentioned earlier about the importance of the CIA, or the College of Industrial Arts, known today as Texas Woman's University. At the time, it was a school specifically for white girls. And so part of how they gathered support to demolish Quakertown was to spread this rumor that Black men in Quakertown posed a threat to the white girls of the school, that Black men would rape the white girls of the school who would walk through Quakertown to get to downtown. And this is coming up during the time of the movie Birth of a Nation, which was very instrumental in spreading these misconceptions and lies about Black men at the time, that they would endanger white women and girls. And the president of the college hosted a screening of The Birth of a Nation on campus around the time that he was circulating the rumor about Black men in Quakertown. And as you all mentioned, some people of Quakertown worked at the college. They weren't too dangerous to work as janitors and as cooks at the university, but they were too dangerous to live and to have their own homes and their own land and their own organizations near the university. It looks like you want to add something, Ms. Randolph.
I was going to say that, was it Mr. Taylor, the one that had the horses? The girls were able to ride, and he was the person who managed all of that. This guy had a great presence on the campus and great responsibility.
Yeah, and Ms. Kimball, who we mentioned earlier, a descendant of Quakertown who's still active, her uncle, right, was a stableman at the college, Jack Cook. So they contributed to the college in many ways. but weren't considered too dangerous for that. So what happened after the 1921 bond vote? What happened to everyone? Like, where did they move? How did they try to rebuild their lives afterwards? What were the challenges? Please share with us.
Okay, well, I'm going to use this term, downtown. The people downtown had got together and started forming these committees that would offer these people so much money for their land, trying to decide what the full prices for their properties should be. So some of the citizens from Quakertown wrote letters telling them, you know, that they wanted to remain and or get the proper amount of money for their homes so that they could move somewhere else, in addition to the general resistance. And some really wanted to stay with their homes. But the city said they had to move. And eventually, I think a man named Mr. Miles, it was a white citizen who was having some financial difficulties and saw a way that if he could sell some of that property, that would also help him to pay off some of his debts. And so he offered that as a place that they could buy land from him and move over there. There was another family, I think it was the Maddox family. Yeah, Henry Maddox. It was Peach Orchard Hill. He had already bought some land there and had a place for three extra homes in addition to his own. But he was also threatened and was so informed that was not a place that they could move. So what we see is it became a project not just to remove people from their little neighborhood, but from white neighborhoods. So where were they to go? And this is where the heart-rending story to me and for many people, like they made those people move. The way they did it and how quickly they were able to bring this into fruition, I think it was over a period of a couple of years. They absolutely were able to force these people out of their little community.
Yeah. And part of the reason why I think it took a couple of years was due to the resilience and the resistance of Black people of Quakertown. So Dr. Moten, and I think Ms. Kimball's uncle, who we mentioned earlier, Jack Cook, were involved in creating a committee among Quakertown townspeople and saying, hey, let's try to negotiate with the city. Because the city was offering prices for their homes and businesses that were way below the market price. So when we talk about the loss of generational wealth, a lot of that happened even within that particular transaction because they never, ever got the money that was equal to the value of their homes, their land, and their businesses. So we see that happening too. Ms. Clark, would you like to add anything about what happened to people after the 1921 bond vote and where they went and what they did to deal with this fallout?
Most of them left. Only a few of them stayed. Some of them went back to their home states, Kentucky, the Carolinas, Virginia. And the few that stayed, it was very devastating to the people, especially to my husband and his family. At that time, he was a young man of about 21, 23 years old. He knew the value of money, and they not only did he have property there, but his mother and his stepfather had property, and they did not give them a fair price for their property. And speaking about Mr. Miles, his family and some of the others moved over to what we call Solomon Hill. But Solomon Hill was a farmland, and they began to purchase land from this Mr. Miles, which was the white man. My husband said that late one evening, just about dusk, he called the man, Old Man Miles, and his brother and a cousin. They was out clearing this farmland, and the Klansmen came and rode up on their horses. Mr. Miles, to get behind the law, of course, by this being farmland, they had encountered all kinds. They had their guns to get your guns and don't shoot unless I tell you to shoot. The Klansmen rode up and they just rode around and they left. So that was his first encounter with the Klansmen. Afterwards, his second encounter was that one of the churches, what they call St. Andrew's Church of God in Christ, wanted to establish a church. And they had a pastor there by the name of Bishop Haynes. And at this time, my husband, being a young man as he was, had a car. Didn't too many Blacks have a car in the early 20s. Mm-hmm. Asked him to take his car to bring some folks back in order to help him establish the church. And they were meeting in a tent over on Cook Street. And the Klansmen came again and egged them with their horses. When you was talking about Mr. Hill, this is a Black man, he and some of the other citizens of Quakertown challenged the city, how they treated them and the amount of money that they were going to give them for their property. It was very devastating to my husband. And he would talk so much about Quakertown till I felt like that I was a resident of Quakertown.
You know, the Peels, this little group that went and tried to talk, work something out, were apparently threatened in such a way that they basically had to drop it. Some of these families Miss Clark mentioned earlier did leave Denton. Dr. Moulton was one of the people, I think, who left fairly early from Denton. And he went back to Indianapolis, Indiana, where he later became head of the Association of Black Physicians in the state of Indiana. The Reverend Ayers, who was the minister at St. Emmanuel's, had to flee at night under darkness and had to leave his family. Mm-hmm. Connected with him later. The Burrs, I think this is the very businesslike woman with the family. They relocated, is the word that they often use, to California. Mm-hmm. John Neal went to Parson, Kansas, which was a railroad town, thinking that they would be able to find somewhere that they could have work and survive there off the railroad. The Crawfords had the funeral parlor in the neighborhood, and the grocery store moved to Kansas also. So we see that families are being separated and the community, the leaders and basically the whole financial base of the community is being destroyed.
The Maddox and the Skinner stayed. The Maddox were an old couple, but they did stay and relocated, and the Skinners too. So in a part of Southeast Denton, we do have two streets that's named from the Maddox and the Skinners too. They happen to stay.
Mm-hmm. And I think in terms of the people who stayed, even though, as you mentioned earlier, Ms. Clark, they continued to deal with racial violence at the hands of the KKK, I think that speaks to the resilience of the people who migrated to Southeast Denton, because it wasn't easy to stay. So to insist on staying in a city where white townspeople really wanted Black people out of Denton, period. And so moving people to Southeast Denton in a flood zone, as Ms. Randolph mentioned earlier, was a way of just getting rid of Black people. And I want to highlight something that was also important about what both of you mentioned in terms of the specific people who left Denton, such as Angelina Burr, who was a midwife. And if we think about the lack of healthcare resources for women in rural towns, period, during this time, but especially dire for Black women during the Jim Crow era. We talk about maternal mortality and all these other healthcare crises that impact Black women today. And a lot of those challenges have roots in the Jim Crow era. So to have someone who worked as a midwife was really important for Black people in Quakertown. And Dr. Moten, I remember when I first interviewed Ms. Clark about Quakertown, and she said, I'll never forget this. She said, having a doctor in a Black town was something.
Yes.
Was something that was just so important during the Jim Crow era. There were only like a handful of Black doctors in the country, period. And Dr. Moten had to leave Texas to get his medical degree because he couldn't get it in Texas. So he really wanted to come home and work as a doctor, you know, in a place that he could call home. And he left. So we see these medical services that were vital to Black people's health and survival leave as well with the economic resources. Also during this time, there was a lack of city services in Southeast Denton. And Ms. Clark, I want to draw you in here too, because you are co-founder of a very important women's group that organized to change the situation in Southeast Denton. So could you tell us what life was like before the group got together and what you all did and what happened after?
I came to Denton in 1962, and I was astonished that when I came here, there was no streets in Southeast Denton paved. And they had no city services, even though they were paying taxes. These services was not provided for them. At nighttime, what few lights, city lights we had, you would go and switch the light on the pole just like you put a light on in your home. When it would rain to the extent that you weren't able to walk, and especially if you would put what we call our Sunday shoes on, and we had to walk to church, we'd have to have what we call galoshes in order to get there. In the spring of 63, it was a very rainy spring, and I even had to put galoshes on to go into my backyard where we had two barrels out there for your garbage disposal. And I couldn't understand why that the city of Denton, Southeast Denton, all these people all this time paying city taxes and had no city services. In 65, when the schools were beginning to integrate, there was a group, white and Black. We called the organization the Denton Christian Women, a racial fellowship group. And this group was formed, and when we got acquainted with each other as women, then we began to reach out in the community. After several months and a year or two of meeting, we divided up to groups. Some of the ladies in the groups went with the white ladies to the downtown areas. Some of us stayed here in our own area. We had a lady, white lady, that was named Trudy Foster. At this time, Denton did not have any type of Black representation on city council either. We wanted the street paved. Along with myself and Trudy and some of the other ladies, a part of the Christian Women Interracial Fellowship Group, we walked the muddy streets of Southeast Denton to get the signatures of the Black homeowners and take it to city council. Trudy was very instrumental in dealing with the city council, very outspoken, and had a very strong voice. And therefore, we were able to get the city to start providing city services for the residents of Southeast Denton. Then some of the ladies went to say that we wanted our ladies and our people not only to work downtown in the stores, maybe as a seamstress or just to clean up, but make them sales clerks. So that was brought about. Even the businesses too. there was a great deal of help that was able to have the transition of the integrating of our school, plus the hiring of qualified Black men and women, give them some white collar jobs.
Yeah, that is so important. And I just want to highlight, and you said this twice, but I think it's so important to highlight even a third time, that Black people were paying city taxes, but were not getting city services, paying taxes out of their wages, right, for city services that they did not get for over 40 years, right? We're talking about 1921 to the 1960s. That's a long time to live without paved roads. You're working hard every day. You have to walk these muddy streets. There's no infrastructure in terms of garbage disposal, no street lights. That's huge. So I just wanted, I see you want to say something too, Ms. Randolph.
That, by the way, the streets being unpaved, that went on in Black neighborhoods and maybe more in Texas for many neighborhoods than meets the eye. I remember those neighborhoods as a young girl. And of course, being in only Black neighborhoods at that time, I would know a lot about those, some of those streets. At first, that group was known as the Interracial Fellowship Group. Later, years later, Christian got into that name. And I do need to make that distinguishing aspect of that name. Now it's known as the Denton Christian Women's Association or whatever. But I remember that group from the other side because I was a student at TWU attending the Presbyterian Church right down from the college, in which a number of those people, including Trudy Foster, Eulene Brock, that whole crew, were in that church. And I helped Ann Barnett with babysitting her children. So I heard about it three times a week as a graduate student whenever I went over there to help while she went to teach organ. I stayed at her house studying my music. That aspect of a lack of services was prevalent throughout the Black community. And I think economically, it's a big deal. And so I think the movement forcing people to move, destroying the neighborhood, took away a source of help for the survival with each other. In other words, the institutions which would be there. So the school was eventually moved. That's one thing. And some of the churches. But those lodges, which were great institutions for benevolence, providing within the community, never got back on its feet like that again.
Never. Did you want to elaborate, Ms. Clark? Because I know some people tried to restart their businesses in Southeast Denton, but they didn't last as long. I remember us having some conversation about that. Did you want to add to how, you know, some things just didn't survive?
Most of them didn't survive. For a while, we did have an area, but as the older folks began to die out and didn't want to deal with the rules and regulations and the laws that the city had provided, we have no really businesses in the city of Denton as today Black business. We have a few barbershops and maybe a beauty shop, but that's all. When I came in 62, there was an area of Denton that it was a very vibrant community, but no longer. And for some cause or another, it has not been able to rejuvenate itself again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I want to get now to how both of you have been leading important efforts to preserve Quakertown's history and to address some of these persistent issues in terms of inequalities that you both mentioned. And before it gets lost, I also want to mention that Alma Clark, along with Betty Kimball and other founding members of the Interracial Fellowship Group, are now featured in a mural in Denton. When was the mural painted, Ms. Clark? Was that 2019, 2020, somewhere in there. I think it's relatively recent.
The mural that's in Southeast Denton, that was done in, I believe, in 2000, and it was at one part of the town. And then they relocated into Southeast Denton at what we call one of the businesses called Morrison Mills, and it's under the underpass there, the railroad underpass. But I believe the one you're referring to is the Christian Women's Group, and it's on Interindustrial Street between a restaurant called Hooch's and an apartment complex there. That's where you will find a lot of us. And this was opened up in 2022, I believe, or 23.
Both are beautiful murals. And for any listeners who might find themselves in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, take a stop and look at the murals. They are just, they're very powerful and moving. But yeah, so could you please share with us more, for example, Ms. Randolph, about what you've been doing with the Quakertown Memorial Committee at Texas Woman's University. And Ms. Clark has been busy all over the city and the area preserving Quakertown's history as well. So yeah, I'd like to begin with you, Ms. Randolph, about what TWU was doing to address this history.
For the last, I guess it's been a good 6 years that TWU has addressed this and acknowledged its role based on what some of the first things that this particular committee did, in which I'm on. And one of the first things was the acknowledgement of this. Another one was some of the things that we could do immediately. And that was to remove that former president's name from one of the most notable buildings on the campus. And that was done very quietly, but you know, nothing is easy.
Right. They didn't advertise it, but it was done.
I'm happy that they had a president who really listened. Also, some people on that campus, as you know, got this grant, which helped to spark that along, I think, as well. But this particular committee eventually came up with the concept of a place on that campus that those people could be commemorated, that something would be done in their honor that would be a teaching memorial as well. That has started being built there. It's an amphitheater with many paths which lead into it and away from it, which represents that journey. The technical aspect of it has not been done yet. I know that because it's supposed to be where you can walk up and press that place, or you hold your phone up against it and you get the whole history of what happened there. So the names of those people will be there.
Mm-hmm.
The things which represent that community. Every street, there would be a map in the very center of this amphitheater. Now, the amphitheater has been built. I've seen it, and I've touched it. We met with engineers, designers, architects, the whole level of all that's involved. So it would be millions of dollars. And because this is a state university, unless somebody is going to step in and donate several million, this has taken time to bring this into fruition. I was hoping that we would see this finished by 23, but I would certainly think within the next couple of years, we'll see exactly how that's going to shape up. And it's very exciting. The campus has to be made ready for that because you needed those landscaping engineers to control the water over there. You need electric. You need so many things that have to work in that part of the campus. In addition to buildings which are being built along that. And as far as I can tell, it's going to be a major entrance into this campus to pass this amphitheater.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the other wonderful thing about platforms like a podcast is you never know who might be listening and wants to contribute to the memorial. So Yeah, that is definitely exciting, especially because, as I mentioned earlier, when I first started teaching at Texas Woman's University, it was taboo to talk about Quakertown.
Yes.
So the idea of just the very idea of a memorial is huge.
The young people on that campus are hungry for it. And you know, from that grant, it's like a hunger to know more.
No, you're absolutely right. When we received the grant, our main goal was to teach students about Quakertown. Because, I mean, the park, which we've mentioned during our conversation, is just literally within walking distance from the campus. And once we started teaching the history across academic disciplines and sociology, chemistry, computer science, English, women's and gender studies, and there's no African American studies program. So students were like eager to hear these stories. The George Floyd protests really fueled that. They got on Twitter and started tweeting the chancellor about Quakertown and saying, hey, this is really rich history. Let's talk more about it. And as you said, she's been really receptive to that. And then there also was a town hall meeting and students performed. So it really has gotten a second life in the city. Ms. Clark, I want to draw you in here as we conclude. Could you tell us about your efforts in the city and what you've been doing to preserve the history of Quakertown?
Denton has what they call a historical park, and they're putting more buildings in there. And one of the houses in there is a Quakertown house, which was my husband's stepfather's house. And I am a, I guess you'd call a docey. When they have a lot of schools that come from in this area, I'm often one of the people. North Texas have a class that they call Ollie. And sometime I go with another lady by the name of Karen Blucher, and we go and talk to the people about Quakertown.
All right. I just want to thank you all. Thank you so much, Ms. Randolph and Ms. Clark, for taking time out of your very busy schedules to share with us your preservation efforts, your thoughts, your perspectives, your knowledge about Quakertown, and the richness of what we call in academia publicly engaged scholarship. You two definitely model that. And so your community work and the fire that remains in you to preserve histories like this is what will keep Black labor history and Black history in general alive for many centuries to come as you preserve it in these alternative spaces, such as museums, this podcast, and memorials. So thank you so very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for listening to A Third of Your Life, the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations podcast. For more information on our academic programs, faculty, and research, visit smlr.rutgers.edu.